Okay, we are back, Dion. So go ahead and ask your question again, if you would, please.
Okay, so the people are coming in. We're going to have dinner when they get here.
All right.
Is it okay to go ahead and start it during dinner, and then they can just start talking to the people who are seated next to them and do it that way? What do you think?
Well, I think what you want to do, I call it commotion. At the very beginning of one of these things, what you want to do is give out enough information that people start to talk. Now,
okay.
when you say get it started, if people are eating and you're trying to get the suspects to give their recollections, it's a little bit distracting.
Okay.
So this is
Denise in Grand Haven. Sorry about that. They said
okay, Denise. Welcome. We're glad you're here. I mean, there are lots of people coming in, so we'll let those beeps stop, and we will continue. Dion has a question about getting a party started with the meal, and one of the things that I like to do with those clues at the beginning is to get people to talk. So when I am facilitating these things, I will go around and I will hand people that letter with the clue attached to the letter, and what I want them to do is start talking to each other and getting to know each other a little bit and to share information, because it's like any good investigation. The more you know, the better off you are. You know, ignorance is not bliss. When you are investigating a crime, knowledge is bliss. So you want to get as much information as possible. Now, the reason on the instructions I put the meal or the break where I do is because through the years I have found that once the suspects give their recollections, there's more to talk about over the meal. So it's like priming the pump. It's like giving them enough information to get the whole thing started. Sounds like somebody has some wind in the background.
I just got in here. This is Andrew Zart.
Hello, Andrew. Nice
How
to have you join us. I'm wonderful. Thank you.
He's with Denise.
If you do that, then what you are actually doing is giving them enough information to keep the investigation going. That's why I break it there. Now, if you try to give the, and I'm assuming, Dion, this is your question, if you try to give the suspect recollections while they are eating, what I have found is that commotion of plates being brought to the table, or just that clatter of dishes, it interferes with the event.
So we'll hand out the stuff as they come in. Okay,
yeah,
that'll work.
Because I like to avoid that one. What I like to do is just make sure that everything is sort of set before they sit down. And any time you sort of distract them with something else going on, it takes away from them getting information. And what you will find, too, at the end, because I've only been doing this for, I hate to even tell you how long I've been doing this, because it really sounds like I'm an old guy, but I've been doing this for about 25 years. And so over the years, I have developed that routine because I know that you've got to focus their attention on what's going on, or at the end, people will say, you know, if I would have just known that, I would have figured it out, but because I was distracted when that came on, I didn't have a chance, you know, and you get all that kind of stuff.
Okay, and so, then you said you rotate them, right?
Yes, what you do when I say rotate, depending upon how many teams you have and how many tables you have, the suspects go from table to table to table during each round of questioning.
Okay.
So they will start off at one table, and you time them at that table, and then you keep on going.
How long do you usually let them sit there?
Well, you know, you can make the call. I say 6 minutes, but it could be five, it could be seven. And what I do at the end is I always have an open round of questioning, because what happens is people, after they have talked with other suspects, they always want to go back and talk to somebody that they've talked to previously. So that's why I do that one.
Okay.
So, Jack, we're doing the petulant. You know what I'm talking about.
Let me see. Would that be murder on the petulant express?
Yeah. And we're the ones that we've got. Andrew is in charge of the college students that are coming in and acting as the suspects.
Okay.
Now we're only going to have five groups. Even though there are eight actors, do you suggest that we have one actor rotate per group and then just like let the other three kind of, you know, eat or something while they're rotating?
I do this all the time. As long as you have fewer teams than suspects, you're fine. If you have more teams than suspects, then it gets to be a little bit of a problem. You simply work out a rotation where three of the suspects are not involved in the questioning at any one time. And it could be that you take sort of suspects one and two and let you know, the person who's at the third table sit down for that round of questioning and then go back to four. But you make a little matrix, and you figure out who's at what table during which round. What I try to avoid is having any one suspect sit down for three consecutive rounds, because I don't want them to get stale. And if you have a kind of party where you have, shall we say, some adult beverages present, that means they're spending 20 minutes at the bar, and I don't really like that when I'm conducting one of these things. So what you want, if you get what I mean, just work out a rotation where three of them are not there for one particular round of questioning.
Okay.
That's the way to do it. I have to ask a favor. Somebody has either wind in the background or is a noise. If you'd put your phone on mute when you're not asking a question, I would appreciate it, because it helps the clarity of the entire call. And by the way, I am recording this call, and I will put a link on the website later today. So if you missed any of the comments, or you have friends that couldn't make it and you'd like them to hear it, there will be a link, and they'll be able to hear the entire call, so you can get all the information again if you would like. Okay. Are there any other questions that I can answer?
Well, I do have one just little nitpicky thing about one of the characters, about Franz the Foxmaster, the brewer.
Brewer, right.
How do you pronounce the brewery that he works at?
I used to live in Germany. It's pronounced, ready for this? Goldenes Lerva.
Okay.
Remember how we used to have this, we still do in some parts of the country, Löwenbräu? Well, in Germany it's pronounced Löwenbräu. And in fact, in Munich, because I've been to the Oktoberfest, and I won't even tell you how many years ago, they've got this wonderful beer hall with this lion up on top, this huge statue of a lion with a beer stein, and it's mechanical. So the lion is actually taking the beer stein and quaffing the beer stein, and when he puts the stein down, he says, Löwenbräu.
Okay.
It is wonderful.
All right, well, okay. That was one of the things I had.
Well, you know, if you look up any kind of German pronunciation, which you can get online, it'll tell you how to pronounce the German words. But Fassmacher's an interesting character, because the Bavarian accent, he's from Bavaria, the Bavarian accent is kind of like a real, how do I put it? In Germany, if you have a Bavarian accent, you're considered to be low class, you see, because the northern Germans, they speak Hochdeutsch, and in Bavaria, they speak what is called Plattdeutsch, which is low German.
Okay.
So it's more of a how do I put it? It's
kind
almost
of like the U.S. speaking in a southern accent.
Now, wait a minute. I don't know who's on this phone. Be careful.
I know. I used to live in the South. It's okay.
Is it more of the high-class London versus Cockney kind of thing?
That's kind of that kind of a comparison would be fair. Yeah, a Bavarian accent is considered a different kind of an accent in Germany. Here's the thing about any kind of a role play that you have, any kind of a suspect that you have, tell them to ham it up. Especially in the ones where, and you may have noticed that I do a little play on words a lot with the role players. And if you have one of those mysteries, then by all means play it up, because I tell people, make it sound like a melodrama. You know, if they want to sort of put their hands on their heads when they are bemoaning the fact that someone died, or they want to put their hands on their hips to emphasize a point, tell them to do it. I mean, really ham it up. That's when it's really a lot of fun.
Right.
Over-dramatize. Okay, great.
Absolutely. Not that I'm dramatic or anything like that, you understand.
Not at all. I can tell you're just close to date.
Any other questions that I can answer for people?
Well, I have another question about when they make their guess, and I know that I'm supposed to not let them change their guesses at the end because they've heard other information, and now they're going, oh, no, now we need to change it.
Right.
Am I allowed to, like, collect their papers, or how have you handled that, or just said, no, right now, like, take your pen away, you can't change, or?
Well, no, I'll tell you how I do that, Dion. I look over people's shoulders. Now, you know, I'm giving you all the tricks of the trade here. I look over people's shoulders when I am sort of roaming around the room as they're filling in the answer sheets. Now, the reason I say that, and I don't let them give me the answer sheet. Some people try. Here's the reason why. some of the best comments and some of the most fun you will have is interacting with the spokesperson of the group. So what you say is, we have team number one here, and who's going to be the spokesperson? And, of course, they all point at each other. Or there's some table where everybody points at this one person who doesn't want to get up and speak. And then you have this interaction with that person. And I'll give you a good example of this, because over Christmas I orchestrated "Twas the Night Before Murder" for a local chapter of the Experimental Aircraft Association. And, of course, here in Wisconsin we have the EAA convention in Oshkosh where they all fly in and the whole bit. Well, one of the role players was the husband, and the spokesperson for the team was the wife. And as she is giving her their solution, the team solution, she's accusing her husband of the crime, and she starts to get really vicious. I mean, it was like this, the saliva was coming out of her mouth, and everybody in the crowd knows that this is the husband and that's really the wife, you know, even though the husband is in character. So I just kind of paused. I took the mic from her, and I said, "This has been building up for years, hasn't it?" And, you know, the whole crowd roared. I mean, you've got to make it like a routine, almost like a... You know, and I hate to use this analogy because it's probably, I used to say Phil Donahue, but nobody knows him anymore. So, okay, Jerry Springer, you know, it's that kind of a thing where you go in the audience and you interact with people in the audience and let them talk to the suspects who are in the front of the room. And really, if you do that one correctly, people are just roaring by the time you're done. Does that make sense?
Okay. Yeah. Unfortunately, it'll be a little bit different because they don't know the actors at all in our party. But
that's okay.
It makes sense.
That's okay. Whether or not they know the actors, I'll give you another example. I mean, this just and you know, obviously I've been doing this for a long time, so my ad libs, they just sort of happen. But in Death in Emdar Hills, my Wild West mystery, I did that for a bank, a group of bankers. The whole audience was people that worked for a bank. And one of the characters in there is a banker in the Old West. And, of course, they come in character. And the derby that he found was too small for his head. It was a little bit too small, so it kind of sat on the top of his head. So as I'm going around the room and getting the answers, one person says, "Why is the banker's hat too small?" And I said, "Well, no, the hat's not too small. He's a banker. His head's too big." And, again... You get the interplay with the audience. And that kind of thing really adds to the entire event. So if you have someone that's very good interacting with the audience, that's what you do. But don't collect the answer sheets, because a big part of it is that interaction where you're letting them give the solutions and then playing off the solutions. And here's what you'll find out, too. Groups who have a hard time figuring out the correct solution will come up with these real oddball, off-the-wall, wild solutions. And they have a better story than you have. And so what I tell people to do is to, how do I put it, pre-program ad libs. You know, have some things ready to say, even though you're not sure when you're going to say them. Like one of the things that I will do, every so often you will get a group that comes out with a solution that has a ton of sexual connotations. It's going to happen. You know, depending upon your group and how much they've had to drink, one group is going to give you all these real wild solutions. Now, I never write those things into my scenarios, but some groups just kind of do it because they think it's kind of funny. So I just sort of pull the mic back and I'll stand there for a few seconds and I will say, "When did the Jerry Springer show start?" You know, that sort of thing. Because people kind of get the idea that, you know, this is sort of way out there. So, you know, prepare a few of those that you can just kind of toss in when you want to, and you'll get a reaction from the crowd. That's really what you want to do. Does that make sense?
I actually have a question about that part of the evening. Are all the actors still in the air, in the room at this time that all these accusations are flying out?
Yeah, here's what I do. That's a good question, Andrew. I don't have this in the instructions, but again, it's something I've developed over the years. What I do is I take the actors aside. I never tell them in advance who did it, because what I have found is that some people just aren't good liars. They just are not good liars. and the other thing that I found out, that's enough, a long time ago, because I used to, at the very beginning of doing this, way back in the dark ages, I used to tell the murderer that he or she had done it. Well, I facilitated one party where, shall we say, the murderer enjoyed his beer, We are in Wisconsin. We are in Wisconsin, after all. So about halfway through the evening, he just blurted out the whole story. He gave it,
No.
Yeah. So it was like, okay, everybody, you can go home now. So I never did that again, because the murderer actually just sort of came out with it, because he'd had too many adult beverages, and he decided that he was going to tell everybody who he was.
Right.
So what I do is I will take the suspects into another room. As soon as I hand out the answer sheets, I will say, suspects, follow me, and I'll find a room or a corner where nobody can hear me, and I will go around with them, because they like to play along too. And here's what I find out, is when they're going around being questioned by other people, they actually learn about the other suspects. It's interesting. People ask me, why do you give so much information about everybody? The answer is, I never know what they're going to ask. You know,
right.
So when I write the role, I give so much information that I'm trying to cover all bases. And you'll find this, that when they are questioning one suspect, they spend a lot of their time asking about the other suspects, which seems counterintuitive, but it's true, because they have this person in front of them, and they're asking about all the other suspects, and they really aren't going into everything they could about this person. Now, that's not always the case, but I find that happens a lot. So I try to give information about all the other suspects so they can answer those questions. And, what you also find is this, that if I forgot to put a piece of information in there, which that team feels is critical, they're going to say, aha, because they didn't know that, then you must be the murderer, okay? Okay, now getting back to the original question. What I do is I take those suspects aside, and I will, one at a time, ask them who they think did it, because they like to play along too. So in private, I will go through all of them and say who did it. And then after everybody gives their guess, I go through the logic of, now this is only about a 12 to 15 minute period, because it does take that long to fill out the answer sheets when the teams start to debate what happened.
Mm-hmm.
I will go in brief through the scenario, and then I will let them, as I go along, follow the logic and figure out who the real murderer is. And then then they know it. So when they come back out, I put them in the front of the room. And what I'd say, if you've read Agatha Christie, it's like the Hercule Poirot moment, you know, where he gets all the suspects together at the end, and he starts talking about each one, and then he sort of ties it all together and says, you did it. And what I tell them is, as I go around the tables, and this table, if any table accuses you, I want them to emote and get very melodramatic, you know.
Okay.
Franz Sassmacher, I think you did it. And Franz goes, what, me? How could you think such a thing? I am such an outstanding German. You know, tell them to really emote and
right.
to deny it. And even though the murderer now knows that he or she did it, tell them to keep denying it. You know, the denial goes all the way to the end. So as each table accuses a particular person, I want that person to interact with that table and say, no, I could not possibly have done it for this reason, that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And at the very end, Andrew, when you are facilitating this and giving out the correct solution, there are a couple of ways you can do this. Now, I do have a little pair of plastic handcuffs that I carry around. Oh, by the way, I used to carry metallic handcuffs around. And this is a true story. I was facilitating a murder mystery in Duck, North Carolina. There really is a Duck, North Carolina, near Kitty Hawk. Kitty Hawk, Duck. Anyway, and I was going through the airport, and guess what? They scanned my bags, and they saw this pair of handcuffs in my bags. And I'm trying to explain, well, no, you see, I do murder mysteries, you know, and this is just a prop. So they go through my bags, and they pull out these handcuffs, and they say, no, these are toy handcuffs. And they say you can't take these on the plane. And I'm going, oh, what's my alternative? They said, well, you're going to have to go back and check them in. And I'm looking, and I'm going, okay, I can play this game. I have enough time. I always get there early for flights. So I went back to the check-in desk, and I walked up there, and I said, I need to check something in. And the girl behind the desk said, what is it? And I pulled out this pair of handcuffs and put them on the counter. And she looked at me, because I had no box or anything else. So she pulls out this huge box. It was like 3 feet long by 2 feet wide, and she tapes my handcuffs inside the box. And, you know, sends them through the baggage claim. So that's how I got my handcuffs there. So that's one way you can do it, is to use the pair of handcuffs and warn the suspect that you're going to put the toy handcuffs on them before you make the arrest. The other way you can do it, and it depends upon who the person is who's playing the murderer, is to have them either yell or scream or run out the room. Either they can run out the room and make it and you've got to chase them, or they get blocked at the door by an assistant who has a policeman's uniform on and don't let them go. So in other words, at the end, have them orchestrate the fact that they did it, if you see what I mean.
Okay. Another small thing, looking at the character bios that you have, how much is usually asked from the thicket of all the stuff and, you know, their childhood, or is most of it from the things about the additional facts that you'll be asked?
I never know.
Okay.
You know, if you have some analyticals in your group, and, you know, when I do this, and I facilitate this with all kinds of groups, if I ever get anybody that's in the financial arena or like computer programmers, technical people, I am amazed at the depth of the questions they ask.
Mm-hmm.
They ask all kinds of stuff that groups who are not analyticals would never ask. So, you know, I can't tell you because I don't know your group, but just be aware that there are some people who are really analytical and who really want to solve it, and because they really want to solve it, they're going to ask every conceivable question you can think of to try to figure it out.
Okay.
Did I answer your questions, by the way?
Yes.
Okay. I want to make sure that you know what's going on, so that's good. Now that
I have,
go ahead.
I was going to say, I have a question. And my name's Amanda, by the way.
Hello, Amanda.
I'm a high school English teacher. I made the mistake of taking this book to work, and one of my classes saw it, got all fired up about it. So now we're doing it as a group thing, which has been really, really interesting. You think adults come up with interesting questions? Try high school kids. My question is this. The scenario that we've got running, it's based in the time period of Jack the Ripper.
Okay.
And what started out as, oh, this will be cool, I get who is Jack the Ripper. So if we're going to wind up doing this, it's actually blowing up really big into, like, we're going to do this as a charity event once we get everything set. But if we're informing other high school kids on this is the scenario and this is who Jack the Ripper is, one of the judges is actually going to get executed.
Are you writing your own, Amanda? Because that's not
yes.
one of my scenarios. Okay, there you go.
Yes.
I was trying to figure out what the heck. When did I write a Jack the Ripper
one? You didn't.
Okay.
Like I said, this has totally snowballed into a whole lot bigger project than I thought it was going to be. But I'm glad the kids are excited, don't get me wrong. I mean, they've got their characters all lined out, and now we're starting to put together all the time pieces where I'm trying to find a G-rated Jack the Ripper thing so I don't get my butt reamed at school. But my thing is, and now...
I got to think about this. A G-rated Jack the Ripper thing. Let me think about it. Is that an oxymoron?
Well, you know, I can't show too
right.
much blood, guts, and gore or give them any ammo for future events, so I've got to be really careful when I show them.
Wait a minute.
But
ammo for future events. I like
ammo.
That. That was a very good pun, Amanda. Very good.
But if, you know, if we wind up having this as a, you know, as a dinner thing and having other students come in paying tickets, raising money for the charity that we've chosen, how do I get the kids that are showing up, not the suspects, but, like, you know, the people who are actually playing along, up to speed of the time period? Do you give them a little history booklet, like, this is the scenario? Because they're not, considering only one person in the class knew who Jack the Ripper was, that kind of bothered
sure.
me a little bit.
Well,
how do you set that up?
Sure. You know, Andrew can probably answer that. You have Murder on the Petulant Express, right?
I do.
Okay. If you take a look at the newspaper in there, that's exactly how I set it up. I have a newspaper, and that's a very good example, because in that one, it takes place in that period of history when the Hindenburg crashed and Amelia Earhart was lost at sea and the whole thing.
Uh-huh.
So I have a two-page newspaper, a simulated newspaper, which I call, ready for this, the Akron Peek-In Journal.
God.
Thank you. You never laugh at good puns. You groan at good puns.
Okay, well, then you succeeded.
Yeah, well, see, what I do is I put a two-page newspaper in there, and what it does is it sets the stage. So when they arrive and you're handing out the initial clues, that newspaper, some of which is historical, and in fact, in that one, the historical facts are correct. in there. Obviously, I stick in a few additional facts about the Petulant Express, but in terms of what happened with the Hindenburg and what happened with Amelia Earhart and the fact that, you know, technology is advancing in Germany, those are all real historical facts. And
right.
if they read the newspaper and they look at it, they kind of get up to speed with that period of history. So what I would suggest is developing a fake English newspaper that has the fake, there'll be some real information in there, but you're going to be putting information in there that also should be clues as to what happened. So, and actually it's a good exercise, because when I do my historical ones, I really research that period of history.
Right, all the characters they wound up picking are actual suspects from Jack the Ripper. They are actually using their names, and they've done the baseline historical facts that these people really existed, and of course they're adding to it with relatives so they can tie all the people together. But
okay, then what I would do, and there, let's see, I forget the name of the inspector on that case, but there was a very famous inspector on the Ripper case. My wife is from England, by the way, so, and my name is Jack, so you figure it out. Anyway, so what I would do is I would make the facilitator or the chief inspector, the real police inspector who investigated the case. And then you supply an article from a fake English newspaper that has some of the facts of the case in there, quoting the chief inspector who is now helping to investigate the case, if you see what I mean.
I do.
So everybody gets this paper in advance, this simulated article about the crimes. And what I always do, of course, is throw some red herrings into the newspaper, too, because a good murder mystery has at least three storylines. So they
right.
can, you know, and go in three different directions and then pick out the one that you got to eliminate two and figure out the right one. But that's the way you do it. You just give them a simulated historical account as they walk in the room and call it today's paper. You know, have you seen today's paper? And in fact, what you could do, because I like to think about how theatrical you can make it, if you have a young kid, say 10, 12 years old, who wouldn't mind putting on sort of a newspaper boy's garb, you know, the knee pants and the flat
right,
hat.
Right.
What you could do is almost say extra newspaper today about the killings on the east side in the docks. Extra. And as they come in, they just, you know, this kid hands them a newspaper, and it's today's paper. That sort of thing.
Okay. Yeah, in fact, we start doing the storylines Monday, so it's like, oh, how convenient! I have this phone call on Saturday, so this is. Like, this whole thing has taken on a life of itself. In fact, the principal's already been up one. Okay, what are you doing? You know, so she's apparently, word's already gotten around. In high school, there's no such thing as a secret. You tell one person, everybody knows. I have my own drama. I don't have to watch soap operas.
In life, there's no such thing as a secret. I've been married for 33 years. Trust me, there's no such thing as a secret.
That was my question.
Okay, was that helpful?
It was. Thank you.
That's my pleasure. And what you'll find, too, this is just a sort of a footnote to the whole thing. What people all tell me is, look, I had 80 people say they're coming. I'll figure 65 will be there. And I'll say, no, if you have 80 people saying they're coming, figure 90 to 100 will be there. Because mysteries tend to take on a different life. What you find is that people say, you know, I've heard about these things for years, and I've never been to one. I want to come, too. So the crowd tends to get bigger rather than smaller, and that's unusual, because with most events you can figure a dropout with the mystery.
Right.
Yeah, so you figure people actually do want to be there.
Cool.
Yeah, it's neat, a lot of fun. But you know something, when you put one of these together and the plot works, it's seamless, and people say, "Gee, that was fun." They don't realize how much work went behind it, Amanda. Do you know what I mean?
I have no doubt.
Because you have to figure out all the. Here's what I tell people, because I get a request to make a different suspect do it, because I have little theater groups that buy them, and they say, look, we want to have one person, they want that game of Clue, you know what I mean?
Right.
Well, tonight it was Colonel Mustard in the study with a wrench. Tomorrow we want Mrs. Peacock in the dining room with a rope.
Right.
Well, if you do your work correctly, you can't do that one, because... my wife has a timer on in the stove. Hold on a second. If you hear that little beep in the background.
Don't you love nagging appliances?
Oh, I love it. Okay. If you do that one correctly, all the dominoes fall in the correct direction. I tell people it's like a game of dominoes, where you put all these dominoes up, and you hit the first domino, and if they all fall in the right direction, you end up with them all down, and everything makes sense. However, if you take even one domino out, or you change the direction of one domino in that whole sequence, the rest of them don't fall. You have to
trade off. Because you've got that path laid out. You can't change the path without everything that you set up.
That's exactly right. So, you know, when you set up that path, you can create red herrings along the way, but if you do your work correctly and everybody follows the logic of what you are saying, only one person could have done it. And believe it or not, and I'm sure you believe it, it takes a while to figure out all of the things that people might ask or that how they could misconstrue something and give them a whole different solution.
Right.
Because they
misread one thing and that'll take them down a whole other path.
That's right. And they'll say, you misled me because you said this. And because you said that, then I thought this, and I asked that, and they said this, and lo and behold, this is really the correct solution. I don't care if you wrote it. I know who did it, and you don't.
Right.
Yeah, it really is a routine that you've got to figure out, and you've got to logically lead them to the correct solution. That's very important.
Does it get easier as you write these things?
It depends. Has anybody on the call purchased my mystery writing workbook or not?
That's what I've got now.
Oh, you've got it right now, Amanda. Okay. Well, then you see how I back into solutions sometimes. Because sometimes what I find is that when it's in my head initially, I have one person doing it. And by the time I start following the logic, another person makes more sense.
Right.
So I kind of back into it because as I'm researching the characters or putting all the characters together, I find that something else makes more sense than what I initially thought had made sense. So it's not like a novel where the mystery writer knows who did it at the very beginning. I almost back into a solution sometimes, even though sometimes at the very beginning I know who I want to do it and that person works out. Sometimes as I'm researching the characters and researching the period, and I also research the death methods, especially if it's poison or something like that, I find that there's something in there that I didn't anticipate. I have what I call an aha moment. It's like, aha, I'd rather do it that way.
Uh-huh.
And I will change the solution and I will change the scenario based upon this other bit of information that I never knew existed when I first started.
From start to finish, how long does it normally take you to write it?
If I start one today, that's a good question too. Because if you count the think time, and that's like the think time as you are driving or working in the yard or taking a shower, the think time takes a couple of months. But you're not putting anything down on paper yet.
Right.
Okay? So the think time sort of, it kind of just rolls right along. When I start to put something down on paper and I'm actually writing, it'll take me 2 to 3 weeks to actually write it. And a big part of that is going back and making sure that my facts are consistent with the person that I wrote before. So I've got to fact check. Because sometimes what I will do is I'll stick in something in one character. And here's the thing. If you add a new fact to one character, what you're finding is you're changing the other role players and the other suspects too. You've got to go back and make sure either that they know about it, don't know about it, or have a reaction to it. So you're constantly going back and forth as you are writing it. And I will get people who do email me about this. Some people are very nice about the fact that I missed something or that was incorrect. Other people get, shall we say, irritated that they paid all of $39 for this and I blew one fact. So that happens. And it's not intentional. It's just that your mind starts going in so many different directions that sometimes you will miss something.
Right.
And I'll go back and correct it when it's mentioned to me. But you know what? Even if there is an incorrect fact in there or some person says something that is not as correct as what they should have said, at the end, everybody has a great time.
Right.
Because I will tell people, well, how did the crowd enjoy it? Well, they enjoyed it. They had a great time, but that one's not right. Okay. Think of the fact that everybody had a great time.
Right.
And if one little fact didn't work, well, it's called life. You know, not everything works.
Pretty much.
Yeah. I know. Any other questions I can answer for people?
I have a question for you. My name's Adam.
Hello, Adam.
You seem to have put up together a really intricate, really detailed story here that's rather difficult. How often do you actually get somebody who has it right?
A lot. It depends upon your audience. What I tell people is I try to, and again, this will change, but in general, I figure that a third of the crowd will figure it out.
Oh,
now, oh yeah. That's a good mystery. And you know, I sometimes get people, does anybody buy a Death is a Cabernet, Old Chum? That's one of my tongue-in-cheek titles, which people, you know, titles sell, by the way. Tongue-in-cheek titles will sell. So anybody who remembers the film Cabaret knows Death is a Cabernet, Old Chum. I got an email one time from one of my customers who said, the plot in there, you know, we had 8 groups and nobody figured it out. I think you made it too difficult and this takes them in this direction. And the funny part was, about 2 weeks before, I had orchestrated the very same mystery for a crowd in Lake Geneva, Wisconsin. And there were five groups, and they all got the right solution. Okay, so I had 5, and they all got it right. This person had 8, and they all got it wrong. You know, you never really know. But the point is, if you don't have enough facts in there to challenge them, I think you are cheating your audience. Now, which one do you have, Adam? Which mystery did you buy?
It's the Murder on the Petchland Express.
Okay, that one is going to be challenging. That's very true. But there are a couple of key clues in there, and if you've read it, you understand what I'm talking about. And there's also, and anybody who read Murder on the Orient Express has a leg up in terms of the correct solution. Do you know what I'm talking about, Adam?
No.
Okay. If you read Murder on the Orient Express, one of the characters is named Grunewald. Andrew, you're still there, right? Of course you are. You know what I'm talking about, right, or not?
I do. I'm working with Andrew. This
okay.
I have read that novel.
Okay, so you know what I'm talking about with the German name in Murder on the Orient Express and Murder on the Petchland Express? Do you know what I'm talking about?
Oh, yes, absolutely.
Okay, so anybody who has read the Murder on the Orient Express has kind of a leg up on part of the solution. So there are things like that that I toss in. And yes, different mysteries have different degrees of difficulty, but what you're looking for is the total thing at the end in terms of whether or not they had a good time.
Mm-hmm.
And whether or not, when you give the solution, it makes sense. You know, in the writing workbook, which Amanda has, what I tell people is you never drop the smoking gun clue until about 75% of the way through the mystery. Here's the reason why. If you drop it too soon and people can figure it out sort of halfway through the mystery, then what are you going to do for the other half of the mystery?
Right.
Right.
Have a smoking gun clue that really points at this one person, then you're going to have all the people at the end kind of say, yeah, but they could have done it because they could have done it and they did this and they could have, so anybody could have done it. That's also bad. So you've got to have one clue or a couple of clues that specifically point only at this one person to be the murderer. And if you can deliver that scenario at the end and show them the logic to it, even if nobody got the correct solution, they will be satisfied that the solution was available to them had they really concentrated on the clues.
Do you want one of those, oh, moments?
Oh, yeah, exactly. Oh, is that what you meant by that? Oh, I didn't think that really was significant. Oh, no, I get it. That's that sort of thing.
Thank you.
That's okay. Again, I've been doing this for a long time, and I get that kind of a thing. I will have parties where nobody gets it, and they still have a great time, and then this one with the Death is a Cabernet when everybody got it, I kind of thought, gee, you know, maybe it is too easy, but everybody still had a great time. And then I get the email that says nobody in our group got it. It must be too difficult. So, you know, go figure. It's one of those things where you say, well, that's life.
This is a heads up for Andrew. He and I are working together, but we're not in the same location for this call.
Okay.
There's going to be 50 or 60 investigators, and I would say that we are probably a more sophisticated group, so be prepared for anything.
Yeah, be careful, Andrew. I have done parties where I've had policemen or detectives there. It is a personal challenge to get the right answer. it's like at the very beginning, people point to them and say, oh, yeah, but he's a detective. Yeah. Oh, you're going, okay, very good. And those people really try to prove their professional expertise and get it right. And I got to tell you, about 80% of the time they do. I mean, it's like, this is what I do for a living. I got to figure this one out. So, yeah, they're the ones you got to watch.
Good.
And by the way, if you have one that's too easy for that crowd, they will feel cheated.
Oh, that's what I thought. That's why I wanted Murder on the Petulant Express, because it's
yeah.
a little bit more sophisticated, more characters, more challenging.
Yeah, and the historical references, too. I like that one just because, well, I'm kind of a history buff, you know. I have two daughters, and my daughters are always saying, Dad, how did you know that? And I always say, doesn't everybody know that? You know, I really enjoy tying all the facts together and doing the historical thing. So that one, especially with that newspaper which you have, you're going to see how that one pulls people into different storylines, and the storylines that are real storylines in the newspaper are carried into characters who are on the train.
Yeah, I love it.
Yeah.
And my husband is a PhD in history. He's ancient history. So it's different, but yeah, I know how these minds work.
How these minds work. I like the way you put that.
It's so true.
It's like my mind doesn't work that way, but I know how these minds work. You must watch Star Trek. You must be like Data, right? Or is it Data? I don't, depending upon which generation you are from. But it's like, oh, yes, very logical and no emotion. We know how these minds work. Okay. Anything else I can answer for you? Do we have any kids' mysteries people on the line? Because I just sent out the same postcard to the people that bought my kids' mysteries.
Yeah, I think it's excellent. I appreciate so much that you do that. I mean, it brings it up a step, okay?
Right. Thank you. That's good. And I, you know, I'd be happy to stay on the line as long as people have questions. But let me just toss out a thing that's happening, and it's going to be a brand new service. And we're a friend of mine named Dan Devitt, and Dan might be on the call right now too. Dan, are you there?
I'm on the call.
Hi, Dan. Dan is a software guy and a very good software guy. And Dan and I were putting together for quite a few months now a site called InstantKidsMystery.com. It is singular, InstantKidsMystery.com. Let me give you an overview of this site and then tell you how it's going to be carried through into other things. On that site, we're taking the kids' mysteries that are on the kids-mysteries.com site and making it so that people can customize them. In other words, you can name the characters, you can name the city that it takes place in, you have some ability to change the storyline with what people say. So you can go through there, and if you want to customize it, you can make it your own. So, you know, if Uncle Fred is a villain, you can put Uncle Fred's name as the villain. You know, you can do anything you want to on the site. So Dan and I are collaborating on that one right now. So here is my special offer to you, because a kid's mystery is $27.97, and the Instant Kid's Mystery, which you can click through and get to Instant Kid's Mystery, is $39.97. It's a $12 increase in price because the programming and the hosting and all cost a little bit more. However, until midnight tomorrow night, if you want to go to the InstantKidsMystery.com site, and we're still putting together the homepage, so it's going to look very basic, the homepage, but that's okay, because this is a thing that is still in a work in progress. And as you are checking out, it will say coupon code. There's a little blank that says coupon code, and it says optional. If you put in the word Sherlock, as in Holmes, so Sherlock, it will take the $12 additional fee and just take it right off, and you will pay no more for the customized mystery than you would pay for a regular kid's mystery. So it's a $12 reduction in price. So if you want to write your own kid's mystery, you won't pay any more for it than you would pay for one of the regular kid's mysteries on the Kid's Mysteries website. And the coupon is good until midnight Eastern time tomorrow, and you can write as many as you want to with that coupon. Now, that's my offer to you, but here's what I want in return. Because with my magic laptop here, I can tell who ordered them. What I'm going to do is email you in about a week or so and ask you for your opinion of the site and do a little problem-solving upgrades with you to find out how you like the site. And that, so that's the reason why I'm offering you the discount, but we want something back in return. Dan and I want to find out how it's working. Because when you are putting something like this together, you don't see it the same way as someone who uses it sees it. Now, next step beyond that. Once we have the Kids Mystery website or the Instant Kids Mystery website taken care of, guess what? We're going to start working on the adult mysteries. Now, the adult mysteries are a little more complicated. There are more pages. The plots are a lot more intricate. There's a lot more branching in there. What we would like to do is develop a site where you can go into the Internet, and we can give you the basic plot, but you can name the characters. You can name the city. You actually have the ability to adjust some of the plot dynamics so that when you buy it, it's not just a standard plot or standard names that you get every other time that you buy it. It's going to be your personal mystery. So I'd like your reaction to that. Anybody want to tell me what you think about that kind of a project?
I think it's great. I'm looking forward to seeing it.
Well, thank you. And like I said, if you buy the Kids Mystery between now and midnight tomorrow, I know who you are because, after all, I am the chief inspector. I will email you and ask you for comments because this is still a work in progress. And now that you know we plan on doing that, feel free to email me and give me any input that you would like about that one. Because I think it's one of those things that people will just really get into, especially if you have a group of people that love to do this kind of thing. You can sit there and, with a series of fill-in-the-blanks and multiple-choice items, actually adjust the plot to fit your particular situation.
Does it also fit an age group, or is it going to be all, like, what are you considering a kids group?
Well, right now, in my kids' mysteries, they go from 8 to 16. Okay? And now, if you haven't been to my Kids Mystery website, and again, the URL is kids-mysteries.com. Put the hyphen in, please, because if not, you go to one of my competitors' websites. I don't want you to do that. You can take a look at the scenarios in there. Here's the reason why that Kids Mystery site got developed. It started, probably about 4 or 5 years ago. I put my website up. I had these mysteries laying around. I now call them the classic mysteries because I've been doing these things for a long time. I put those up on my website 5, 6 years ago, probably 6 years ago, just as a experimental thing to see if people would buy them. So I put my three classic mysteries up, put up the website, learned a little bit about search engines and positioned my website, and lo and behold, the very first month I had done it, I saw, with only three mysteries up, my profit was $897. And I went, wait a minute, why am I doing what I do? Why not do more mysteries? So I that's how the whole site got developed. It was just an experimental kind of a thing, and it worked. Then I started getting requests from people, teachers and people who didn't like the gory thing about murders. Jack the Ripper would never go with these groups. I used to get requests that said, do you have any murder mysteries without the murder? Nobody laughed at that one, but I kind of chuckled. How could it be a murder mystery? So what I did was I developed the Kids Mystery website because on the Kids Mysteries website, there are no murders. Something is lost, something happened, and the kids have to figure out what went on. I get a lot of teachers that buy my Kids Mysteries. And another future project, and I've already registered the URL. There's nothing there right now, but eventually you'll find something at classroommysteries.com. My intent is to find a group of teachers as a group to work with and develop lesson plans and everything else around the kids' mysteries. So rather than just buy the mystery, what you will also find are questions and all that you can ask the group, and you're going to find things that you can do before and after, and the mystery becomes a learning experience as opposed to just a fun experience. So that's also in the works. But none of the kids' mysteries have deaths. They all have scenarios that involve putting on your thinking cap and trying to figure out what happened, but nobody dies in any of the kids' mysteries.
That would be cool.
Well, good, because that's in the works. That's another one's in the works.
I teach high school English, so I can see doing that with novels like 1984 or whenever the main character in finds out that he gets turned in and why, and evolving a mystery around something like that or other novels of choice.
Yeah, well, that's great. I appreciate that because a significant part of my customer base on the Kids Mystery website is teachers. And they like them. And I have schools that buy a whole series of my kids' mysteries to use in different classes. And in fact, if you haven't been there recently, if you do go there, you're going to see that some of them have been put on CD-ROMs, because I frequently get calls and say, oh, I downloaded it onto my computer. How do I get it to somebody else's computer? That kind of thing. So with a CD-ROM, what you can do is actually put it on the shelf. Anybody who wants to use it can just go over to the shelf, pull it off, and get all the material. You don't have to worry about files and computers and things like that and crashes and all that sort of thing. You now have it on a permanent CD that can be used again and again. So that's also getting to, well, it's on there right now. Not all the mysteries are there yet, but a lot of them are there. So you can buy them on CD-ROMs.
That's a fantastic idea, too, because I teach outdoor education, and we've been looking to put together an event to kind of showcase our the camp that I work at, and I think that would be a fantastic event to have people out.
Well, that's great. And, you know, the thing is, too, with those CDs, they are there right now, and you can buy them right now. I'm always looking for ways to make them better, and there are other things that can be done. And this again, you kind of go both ways in some of these things. Audio files are great. And one of the things you can do is put them on the CD, or you can have them available on the Internet to help set the stage. The thing is, if you have it, because I've facilitated many big groups, if you have a group of 100 people, having an audio file can be a little bit tricky. If you can play it over loudspeakers, it's fine. If you have it on a computer, it's not as fine. There are some dynamics in there that are not as controllable as just facilitating it yourself and knowing the material and knowing the suspects. So you've got both of those things to consider. The other thing that I'm considering doing, and I'll toss this one out too to give you an idea, I am considering having, for lack of a better term, a mystery writing weekend for people that can join me here in the glacial hills of southeastern Wisconsin and simply spend a weekend with anybody who wants to write their own mystery. So you would pay all your own expenses, but I've got this wonderful acre. In fact, I'm looking out at a chickadee in my crabapple tree right now. We've got a wonderful acre of land in southeastern Wisconsin in a nice area that tourists come to. You know, we get all the tour buses from Chicago with the little ladies with the big checkbooks to come buy all of our stuff. And long may it rain. If you look at cedarburg.org, and that's with a U, cedarburg.com, pardon me, .org, you will see where I live. It's an old mill town. The first woolen mill in the Northwest Territory was in Cedarburg. We have a nice little creek with nice little ducks floating on the pond, and my daughters say they didn't realize how quaint Cedarburg was until they moved to Minneapolis, and now they realize we are quaint, you know. So part of my idea is to invite people to come and join me for a long weekend. Come in Friday, leave Sunday, with the idea that by the time you leave, you will have a mystery written. Plus, if you bring your significant other, you can spend a really nice weekend in a really nice area up by the Great Lakes. But please come in the summer, unless you like cross-country skiing and snowshoeing, because we do get a little snow up here. How does that idea sound to all of you? Is that something that might interest you?
Yeah, definitely.
Because what I would like to do is put up some information on a website, and it would be one of those structured, non-structured events, structured in the sense that we will get a mystery written, non-structured in the sense that I need to meet your needs in terms of what you're looking for, and a lot of the interplay would be just like we had on the phone, which is answering questions and responding and kind of going in a direction and even doing some research on the Internet while we're here and just sort of putting together the whole scenario so by the time you leave, you've got something that you can use. So, any other questions I can answer? I gave you the special offer. I told you some of the ideas that are coming up. Those of you who bought kids' mysteries, do you have any questions that I can answer, or that Dan might be able to answer too, because Dan's been helping me with doing some of the transition to the instant kids' mystery? You mean I've answered everything?
No, I have one, but it's...
Okay, since we have no kids' mysteries jumping in, go ahead. Anybody can ask anything. Go ahead.
I want to go back to what you were. I like your idea about using the high school teachers. Do you wonder why? Is there a way to set it up where instead using? Yeah, I know. One thought at a time. Sorry, you've really got my mind running now.
Oh, that's good. I like minds that are running. It's better than noses that are running. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Four of the classes I teach are world lit.
Okay.
sophomores, which are roughly anywhere from the age of 14 to 16. When you set up teams, is there a way to, are you going to be able to incorporate setting it up by class so each class is on the hunt rather than individual students? Can you do it that way?
I'm not sure I understand the question. When you say each class, you'd be having it so that different classes are trying to solve the case, is that it?
Right. Instead of having it, you know, where you've got, you know, six suspects and 50 people trying to figure out who did it, you still have the same suspects, but set it up as a class basis is what team, can a team be too big?
I suggest no bigger than 10 or 12, okay?
Yeah, my classes are bigger than that.
Well, yeah, but within the class itself, you can have teams.
Okay.
The class doesn't have to be one team. It can be several teams. In fact, if you're going to set it up with different classrooms, I'd suggest sort of three or four teams in each classroom. And then let me give you a scenario about how I've suggested to some of my clients how they could handle a different kind of a mystery, but I think it will give you some insight into how you can handle it in the school.
Okay.
If you go online and look up Death is a Cabernet, Old Chum, what you'll see is that there is a group of wineries in upper New York State that use that mystery as an event to get everybody to different wineries. What I suggested they do and what they are doing is they are taking a suspect and putting a suspect at each winery along the way. So when the person hits one of the wineries, they're saying, oh, today is the murder mystery weekend, and if you want to question all the suspects, you have to go to all these wineries because there's one suspect at each winery that you can question and try to figure out what happened. And then they fill in the answer sheet after they've hit all the wineries, and those that either get the answer or come closest to the answer get a prize. Let me guess, what would the prize be? Oh, I know, probably wine. What do you think? So that's one way they handle it. And I've also had a group of B&Bs in Lake Geneva do the same thing, where they buy a mystery, and when people come for the mystery weekend, they orchestrate different suspects being at different B&Bs so that they have to hit all the B&Bs. And, of course, while they're at the B&B, they get the hype about how wonderful this B&B is and the area and the whole thing. There are a variety of groups like that, that they sort of go from place to place to place to get all the suspects. So taking that back to the classroom situation, you could have a suspect or two suspects in each class, and the teams either have to, it's almost like a scavenger hunt. You got to get to all the suspects and get all the information to be able to solve the case. Now, if you're dealing with that age group, and I say up to 16 with the kids' mysteries, I have a lot of younger teens who use the murder mysteries. Because if you've bought my mysteries, and all of you have, you notice I don't have any gory mysteries.
Right.
I do Agatha Christie-type mysteries, which is, oh, look, somebody died. Okay, at least there wasn't any blood and guts. There's no Jack the Ripper in my scenario.
We're not actually going to have anybody bleed as much as they want to, but, you know, hey, it works.
I know. Maybe call him Fred the Zipper or something. I don't know. But the point is that none of the mysteries have anything gory that would offend parents or make people go to the school board. So if you have a murder mystery, especially the ones where the person sort of falls over dead because either that's, well, I don't want to give all the solutions out, but it's either poison or a poison dart, or it's something that was sort of stashed like a booby trap someplace. So it's a really non-gory kind of a mystery. Younger teens can get into that stuff. Hey, just watch TV at night. They see worse than that on TV every night.
Absolutely.
So, you know, it's not that big of a deal. But I do have some parents and some groups that don't like that kind of stuff. So that's why I give them the kids' mystery option. But if you did that, then you could even... one of the things that some of my customers do, and I've done it too when I facilitate, is set up a crime scene. So some of the police reports that are included in my kits, they simply set up the crime scene and incorporate all the stuff I have in my police reports into the crime scene. And they mask it off, you know, with the police. It says police investigation, do not cross, or police area, do not cross, that yellow tape. And luckily, I'm friends with the local police department, so I've got some of that tape. But you can map off the crime scene and just let people take a look. That substitutes for some of the police reports that I give you in the kits. So there's a variety of things you could do. And in a school like that, if you want to, if you could do it, you could set up the crime scene. And, you know, you have that tape, and the kids can go look, but they can't cross. Or you can have somebody set up there in a police uniform that knows a few additional facts. See, part of a good mystery is to ask the right questions. So that question I got before, those are all people leaving. It's not, I understand. It's, you know, 12:30 here in Central Time, but different times. What I do is have it so that they have to ask questions to get all the information. I don't just give them everything. I make it so they have to pull information to get the case. If you give them everything, then it becomes a theatrical production, and they have all the information they need without doing anything. It's a play. I don't set up my scenarios that way. I set up my scenarios so that I tease them with information, giving them a little bit about stuff they should know about, but making it so they have to pull out the rest of the information to be able to solve the case. Does that make sense?
It does.
Yeah. So
make their brains work a little bit. They feel
that's
like
right.
Participatory rather than just playing along.
That's right. Because if I give you everything, then you don't have to really think about what I'm giving you. I've got it right here. Or if I only give you part of it, then you've got to ask the right questions to get the right information, which goes back to the answer to one of the questions about why you give us so much, because I never know what you're going to ask. Therefore, I want to give you enough that I can answer your question.
Mm-hmm. Cool.
Did that help?
Yeah. It helped a lot. I'm sorry. I'm sitting here writing, too. I tend to be a list person.
I charge 10 cents a word, so... no, never mind. I'm just kidding.
Now, this has been great. I'm glad I called in.
Well, I'm glad you're glad. In fact, I'm going to be doing this on a regular basis with... As I get a certain number of customers that have bought mysteries, I send them out the postcards. Let me ask you this, and this is my own personal problem-solving or information-gathering thing. Why did you buy from my site rather than somebody else's site? Can anybody tell me that who's on the call?
I can. I love doing research. And when I came up with this idea initially to use with the kids, a little bit of background, I did my dissertation on study skills.
Okay.
I don't think kids are stupid. I just truly understand they don't get how to study. So any way that I can make my kids interact and get the point and make them think outside the box, I'm pretty much reputable to do in the school, which is why my principal loves me so much, and I get plenty of visits from her. So when I started researching about, I put in high school murder mystery games, and your site kept coming up over and over and over, and then I found other people who had commented on your site, all positive. I never found one bad thing about your site at all, and I never put those up.
Huh? I never put the bad ones up. So.
But the more I came back to it, and then I saw the samples that you had, and then I downloaded the first one, and I went, oh, this will work, and then I got the book, and then I got a second one, because I wanted to get two very different mysteries to see, you know, to compare and contrast. I'm very impressed with everything that I've seen so far.
Thank you. Thank you. It does take a while to put one of these things together, but it just shows you the devious nature of my brain, see?
Oh, well, see, you and I think alike. This would be even more dangerous because I'm thinking,
oh, nobody thinks like me. I'm sorry.
But I was actually very impressed with everything, and I'm the, like, queen of research. It's a running joke. And I was very impressed with everything that I found and everything I saw within your site. And your site's very user-friendly, too.
Oh, well, thank you. Thank you. I get a lot of comments about how basic the site looks, and my reaction is, yeah, that's right, because you can go to some sites and you get lost in the navigation, and I don't want you to get lost in the navigation. At least that's the way I
right. Do. No, I mean, it's not, doesn't make you feel stupid. You want to find what you want to find, that you're online for a reason. You want that information now.
Okay.
So when you go online and click on stuff, which is what I did, and I mean, I clicked through all of your mysteries. I read the synopsis for everything that you had. Like I said, I do my research thoroughly. And it was so easy to navigate.
Okay.
I was very impressed all the way around, which is what made me buy from you.
Oh, well, that's great. Thank you. That's good input. I appreciate that. And what you're going to find, too, is that especially if there's a poisoning or anything like that in the scenario that you bought, there really is a poison like that, and that it really does react the way that I said it reacts, because I do my research, too.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, when I was researching one of my mysteries and trying to find a way to kill somebody, I went to a high school science teacher and asked him how I could do it, and he gave me one way to do it, and I researched and didn't like that way. So I actually did my own research and went back to him and said, here's the way that I decided to do it, which is different than what you told me to do, you know.
Right.
Okay, anybody else have any questions that I can answer?
I have a question just out of curiosity, because you have been doing this so long. Would you have any suggestions on dealing with family groups?
Can you be a little more specific on that?
I'd like to do an event and incorporate, you know, bring in families to come and do the murder mystery.
Well, I will tell you what,
you know,
what the most
kids.
Yeah, the most popular one for that is Death in Nemnar Hills. And if you take a look at my website, you're going to see quite a few references from people that have done family reunions and family groups. I think there was one in Pine, Arizona that I know of that did that. I think there's one at the top, I think it's Beverly Hartman, I believe is the name, from San Antonio, Texas, who also did a family group. And the reason for that is that it's Wild West. Kids tend to like the Wild West theme, although there's nothing in the plot that would have any kind of a problem with kids. With my large group version, there are 20 additional what I call minor roles. So there are 10 major characters, and there are 20 minor roles. The minor roles, none of the minor roles did it, but they all know something about what happened. So what that means is that people who are not assigned major character roles can still have a little bit of knowledge that they can go around and talk to people about. And the nice thing about a Wild West mystery is everybody has a plaid shirt and a pair of jeans and can find a work hanky and find a cowboy hat. So everybody can come in costume. The costume is extremely easy. Well, with some of the other mysteries, you got to think a little bit about what the costuming is like. So if you take a look at that one is very popular with family groups. And like I said, you'll see quite a few references from groups that have used it.
All right. And do you have any suggestions as to the planning of the event and advertising of it?
Okay, advertising, you say a family group. And, I have hotels that use my mysteries. I have little theater groups that use my mysteries. What kind, I mean, is it a facility? Exactly what kind of a thing is it?
It's actually a summer camp.
Summer camp, okay. Are there any kind of magazines or websites that you advertise in?
Well, we are associated with the YMCA, so I could advertise through that.
Yeah, that, and I don't know how it works where you are, but I know that a hotel in Stevens Point, Wisconsin, used Death in Nemnar Hills a few weeks ago. I had a great time with it. They had like 120, 130 people, and they actually advertised on National Public Radio.
Oh,
I was listening to Michael. I was in Michael Feldman's audience a couple of years ago. If you listen to National Public Radio, I've also been in Garrison Keillor's audience too, because he's in Minnesota and I'm right next door. But I'm listening to to Jim Packard at the end, and he's saying and the Stevens Point Ramada Inn with their murder mystery Death in Nemnar Hills, and my wife and I both stopped and said, "Hey, that's yours." And the hotel actually called me and said, which one can we use next? Because we had such a great time and it worked so well. What do you recommend for the next one? So, you know, National Public Radio, any kind of free bulletin boards, you would be surprised, maybe you wouldn't be surprised, at how many customers I get because somebody posted something on a bulletin board and said nice things about it, and I will get somebody buy one of my mysteries because of bulletin boards. The nice thing about cyberspace is anybody, any place in the world can see it once it's out there. I have literally sold mysteries on 6 continents, and if I can ever find a penguin who wants to do a murder mystery, I can sell it on 7. So, any other questions I can answer for you? Okay, well, this has been a great session. I thank all of you for calling in. What I'm going to do is I'm going to put a link to this conversation. This has been recorded. So if you do want to go back into it and hear what we said, it will be available on my website. And you can just click in and hear the entire conversation. You'll be able to speed it up and slow it down and the whole thing. But you can kind of recap what went on and get any ideas for the next time that you want to do a mystery. So thank you all for being here. Please take advantage of the Instant Kids Mystery offer. So enter Sherlock in the coupon code, and it'll take it right back down to the regular price of the Kids Mystery. And then I really do want to hear your comments about how you think things went. So thank you so much, and may we meet again in the land of sleuthing. We will talk. Bye.